ancestral environment, a man could know which children were biologically his, which presumes that he understands that one sex act can lead to a child, and he has 100% certainty of his partner's fidelity. A hunter could refuse to share his catch with other hungry people living in the close-knit band of foragers, including nieces, nephews, and children of lifelong friends, without being shamed, shunned, and banished from the community. So, according to the standard narrative, as male parental investment translates into advantages for that man's children, more food, protection, and education, other kids be damned, women would have evolved to choose mates with access to more of these resources, and whose behavior indicated that they would share these resources only with her and her children, indications of selective generosity, fidelity, and sincerity. But according to this narrative, these two female objectives, good genes and access to a male's resources, create conflictive situations for men and women, both within their relationship and with their same-sex competitors. Wright summarizes this understanding of the situation. High male parental investment makes sexual selection work in two directions at once. Not only have males evolved to compete for scarce female eggs, females have evolved to compete for scarce male investment. Mixed strategies in the war between the sexes. It's no accident that the man who famously observed that power is the greatest aphrodisiac was not, by a long shot, good-looking. Often, in what we might call the Kissinger effect, the men with the greatest access to resources and status lack the genetic wealth signified by physical attractiveness. What's a girl to do? Conventional theory suggests she'll marry a nice, rich, predictable, sincere guy likely to pay the mortgage, change the diapers, and take out the trash, but then cheat on him with wild, sexy, dangerous dudes, especially around the time she's ovulating, so she's more likely to have lover boy's baby. Known as the mixed strategy in the scientific literature, both males and females are said to employ their own version of the dark strategy in keeping with their opposed objectives in mating. Females maximizing quality of mates, and males maximizing quantity of mating opportunities. It's a jungle out there. The best-known studies purporting to demonstrate the nature of these two differing strategies are those done by David Buss and his colleagues. Their hypothesis holds that if males and females have conflicting agendas concerning mating behavior, the differences should appear in the ways males and females experience sexual jealousy. These researchers found that women were consistently more upset by thoughts of their mates' emotional infidelity, while men showed more anxiety concerning their mates' sexual infidelity, as the hypothesis predicts. These results are often cited as confirmation of the male parental investment-based model. They appear to reflect the differing interests the model predicts. A woman, according to the theory, would be more upset about her partner's emotional involvement with another woman, as that would threaten her vital interests more. According to the standard model, the worst-case scenario for a prehistoric woman in this evolutionary game would be to lose access to her man's resources and support. If he limits himself to a meaningless sexual dalliance with another woman, in modern terms, preferably a woman of a lower social class or a prostitute, whom he would be unlikely to marry, this would be far less threatening to her standard of living and that of her children. However, if he were to fall in love with another woman and leave, the woman's prospects and those of her children would plummet. From the man's perspective, as noted above, the worst-case scenario would be to spend his time and resources raising another man's children and propelling someone else's genes into the future at the expense of his own. If his partner were to have an emotional connection with another man but no sex, this genetic catastrophe couldn't happen. But if she were to have sex with another man, even if no emotional intimacy were involved, he could find himself unknowingly losing his evolutionary investment. Hence, the narrative predicts, and the research seems to confirm, that his jealousy should have evolved to control her sexual behavior, thus assuring paternity of the children, while her jealousy should be oriented toward controlling his emotional behavior, thus protecting her exclusive access to his resources. As you might guess, the mixed strategy referred to earlier would follow similar lines. The male's mixed strategy would be to have a long-term mate whose sexual behavior he could control, keeping her barefoot and pregnant if poor, foot-bound and pregnant if Chinese, or in high heels and pregnant if rich. Meanwhile, he should continue having casual, low-investment sex with as many other women as possible to increase his chances of fathering more children. This is how standard evolutionary theory posits that men evolved to be dirty, lying bastards. According to the standard narrative, the evolved behavioral strategy for a man is to cheat on his pregnant wife while being insanely, even violently, jealous of her. Charming. Although the survival odds of any children resulting from his casual encounters would presumably be lower than those of the children he helps raise, this investment would still be wise for him, given the low costs he incurs, a few drinks and a room at the Shady Grove Motor Lodge at the hourly rate. The woman's mixed strategy would be to extract a long-term commitment from the man who offers her the best access to resources, status, and protection, while still seeking the occasional fling with rugged dudes in leather jackets who offer genetic advantages her loving but domesticated mate lacks. It's hard to decide who comes out looking worse. Various studies have demonstrated that women are more likely to cheat on their husbands, to have extra pair copulations, or EPCs, when they are ovulating, and less likely to use birth control than they are when not fertile. Furthermore, women are likely to wear more perfume and jewelry when ovulating than at other points in their menstrual cycle, and to be attracted to more macho-looking men, those with physical markers of more vigorous genes. These conflicting agendas and the eternal struggle they appear to fuel, this war between the sexes, is central to the dismal vision of human sexual life featured in today's scientific and therapeutic narratives. As Wright summarizes, even with high MPI, male parental investment, and in some ways because of it, a basic underlying dynamic between men and women is mutual exploitation. They seem at times designed to make each other miserable. Simmons voices the same resignation in the first lines of The Evolution of Human Sexuality. A central theme of this book is that, with respect to sexuality, there is a female human nature and a male human nature, and that these natures are extraordinarily different, though the differences are, to some extent, masked by the compromises heterosexual relations entail and by moral injunctions. Men and women differ in their sexual natures because throughout the immensely long hunting and gathering phase of human evolutionary history, the sexual desires and dispositions that were adaptive for either sex were, for the other, tickets to reproductive oblivion. Bleak, no? Conventional evolutionary theory assures us that all you scheming, gold-digging women reading this are evolved to trick a trusting yet boring guy into marrying you, only to then spray on a bunch of perfume and run down to the local singles club to try to get pregnant by some unshaven Neanderthal as soon as hubby falls asleep on the couch. How could you? But before male readers start feeling superior, remember that, according to the same narrative, you evolved to woo and marry some innocent young beauty with empty promises of undying love, fake Rolex prominent on your wrist, get her pregnant ASAP, then start working late with as many secretaries as you can manage. Nothing to be proud of, mister. Extended sexual receptivity and concealed ovulation. Unlike her closest primate cousins, the standard human female doesn't come equipped with private parts that swell up to double their normal size and turn bright red when she is about to ovulate. In fact, a foundational premise of the standard narrative is that men have no way of knowing when a woman is fertile. As we're supposed to be the smartest creatures around, it's interesting that humans are thought to be almost unique in this ignorance. The vast majority of other female mammals advertise when they are fertile and are decidedly not interested in sex at other times. Concealed ovulation is said to be a significant human exception. Among primates, the female capacity and willingness to have sex any time, any place, is characteristic only of bonobos and humans. Extended receptivity is just a scientific way of saying that women can be sexually active throughout their menstrual cycle, whereas most mammals have sex only when it matters, that is, when pregnancy can occur. If we accept the assumption that women are not particularly interested in sex, other than as a way to manipulate men into sharing resources, why would human females have evolved this unusually abundant sexual capacity? Why not reserve sex for those few days in the cycle when pregnancy is most probable, as does practically every other mammal? Two principal theories have been proposed to explain this phenomenon, and they couldn't be more different. What anthropologist Helen Fisher has called the classic explanation goes like this. Both concealed ovulation and extended, or more accurately, constant sexual receptivity evolved among early human females as a way of developing and cementing the pair bond by holding the attention of a constantly horny male mate. This capacity supposedly worked in two ways. First, because she was always available for sex, even when not ovulating, there was no reason for him to seek other females for sexual pleasure. Second, because her fertility was hidden, he would be motivated to stick around all the time to maximize his own probability of impregnating her and to ensure that no other males mated with her at any time, not just during a brief estrus phase. Fisher says, silent ovulation kept a special friend in constant close proximity, providing protection and food the female prized. Known as mate-guarding behavior to scientists, contemporary women might call it that insecure pest who never leaves me alone. Anthropologist Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy offers a different explanation for the unusual sexual capacity of the human female. She suggests that concealed ovulation and extended receptivity in early hominids may have evolved not to reassure males, but to confuse them. Having noted the tendency of newly enthroned alpha male baboons to kill all the babies of the previous patriarch, Hurdy hypothesized that this aspect of female sexuality may have developed as a way of confusing paternity among various males. The female would have sex with several males so that none of them could be certain of paternity, thus reducing the likelihood that the next alpha male would kill offspring who could be his. So, we've got Fisher's classic theory, proposing that women evolved their special sexiness as a way of keeping one man's interest, and Hurdy saying it's all about keeping several guys guessing. Fisher's theory fits better with the standard model, in which females trade sex for food, protection, and so forth, but this explanation works only if we believe that males, including our primitive ancestors, were interested in sex all the time with just one female. This contradicts the premise that males are hell-bent on spreading their seed far and wide while simultaneously protecting their investment in their primary mate slash family. Hurdy's seeds of confusion theory posits that concealed ovulation and constant receptivity would benefit a female who had multiple male partners by preventing them from killing her offspring and inducing them to defend or otherwise aid her children. Hurdy's vision of human sexual evolution puts females directly at odds with males, who would presumably view fertile females as individually recognizable and potentially defensible resource packets too valuable to share. Either way, as depicted in the standard narrative, human sexual prehistory was characterized by deceit, disappointment, and despair. According to this view, both males and females are, by nature, liars, whores, and cheats. At our most basic levels, we're told, heterosexual men and women have evolved to trick one another while selfishly pursuing zero-sum, mutually antagonistic genetic agendas, even though this demands the betrayal of the people we claim to love most sincerely. Original sin, indeed. Chapter 4. The Ape in the Mirror.
Why should our nastiness be the baggage of an apish past, and our kindness uniquely human? Why should we not seek continuity with other animals for our noble traits as well? Stephen Jay Gould. 'Tis from the resemblance of the external actions of animals to those we ourselves perform that we judge their internal likewise to resemble ours. And the same principle of reasoning, carried one step farther, will make us conclude that since our internal actions resemble each other, the causes from which they are derived must also be resembling. When any hypothesis, therefore, is advanced to explain a mental operation which is common to men and beasts, we must apply the same hypothesis to both. David Hume, A Treatise of Human Nature, 1739 to 1740.
Genetically, the chimps and bonobos at the zoo are far closer to you and the other paying customers than they are to the gorillas, orangutans, monkeys, or anything else in a cage. Our DNA differs from that of chimps and bonobos by roughly 1.6%, making us closer to them than a dog is to a fox, a white-handed gibbon to a white-cheeked crested gibbon, an Indian elephant to an African elephant, or, for any bird watchers who may be tuning in, a red-eyed vireo to a white-eyed vireo. The ancestral line leading to chimps and bonobos splits off from that leading to humans just 5 to 6 million years ago, though interbreeding probably continued for a million or so years after the split, with the chimp and bonobo line separating somewhere between 3 million and 860,000 years ago. Beyond these two close cousins, the familial distances to other primates grow much larger. The gorilla peeled away from the common line around 9 million years ago, orangutans 16 million, and gibbons, the only monogamous ape, took an early exit about 22 million years ago. DNA evidence indicates that the last common ancestor for apes and monkeys lived about 30 million years ago. If you picture this relative genetic distance from humans geographically, with a mile representing about 100,000 years since we last shared a common ancestor, it might look something like this. Homo sapiens sapiens, New York, New York. Chimps and bonobos are practically neighbors, living within 30 miles of each other in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Yorktown Heights, New York. Both just 50 miles from New York, they are well within commuting distance of humanity. Gorillas are enjoying cheesesteaks in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Orangutans are in Baltimore, Maryland, doing whatever it is people do in Baltimore. Gibbons are busily legislating monogamy in Washington, D.C. Old world monkeys, baboons, macaques, are down around Roanoke, Virginia. Carl Linnaeus, the first to make the taxonomic distinction between humans and chimps in the mid-18th century, came to wish he hadn't. This division, pan and homo, is now regarded as being without scientific justification, and many biologists advocate reclassifying humans, chimps, and bonobos together to reflect our striking similarities. Nicholas Tulp, a well-known Dutch anatomist immortalized in Rembrandt's painting The Anatomy Lesson, produced the earliest accurate description of a non-human ape's anatomy in 1641. The body Tulp dissected so closely resembled a human's that he commented that it would be hard to find one egg more like another. Although Tulp called his specimen an Indian satyr and noted that local people called it an orangutan, contemporary primatologists who have studied Tulp's notes believe it was a bonobo. Like us, chimps and bonobos are African great apes. Like all apes, they have no tail. They spend a good part of their lives on the ground and are both highly intelligent, intensely social creatures. For bonobos, a turbocharged sexuality, utterly divorced from reproduction, is a central feature of social interaction and group cohesion. Anthropologist Marvin Harris argues that bonobos get a reproductive payoff that compensates them for their wasteful approach to hitting the ovulatory target. The payoff is a more intense form of social cooperation between males and females, leading to a more intensely cooperative social group, a more secure milieu for rearing infants, and hence a higher degree of reproductive success for sexier males and females. The bonobo's promiscuity, in other words, confers significant evolutionary benefits on the apes. The only monogamous ape, the gibbon, lives in Southeast Asia in small family units consisting of a male-female couple and their young, isolated in a territory of 30 to 50 square kilometers. They never leave the trees, have little to no interaction with other gibbon groups, not much advanced intelligence to speak of, and infrequent reproduction-only copulation. Monogamy is not found in any social group-living primate except, if the standard narrative is to be believed, us. Anthropologist Donald Simmons is as amazed as we are at frequent attempts to argue that monogamous gibbons could serve as viable models for human sexuality, writing, "Talk of why or whether humans pair bond like gibbons strikes me as belonging to the same realm of discourse as talk of why the sea is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings." Primates and Human Nature. If Thomas Hobbes had been offered the opportunity to design an animal that embodied his darkest convictions about human nature, he might have come up with something like a chimpanzee. This ape appears to confirm every dire Hobbesian assumption about the inherent nastiness of pre-state existence. Chimps are reported to be power-mad, jealous, quick to violence, devious, and aggressive. Murder, organized warfare between groups, rape, and infanticide are prominent in accounts of their behavior. Once these chilling observations were published in the 1960s, theorists quickly proposed the killer ape theory of human origins. Primatologists Richard Wrangham and Dale Peterson summarized this demonic theory in stark terms, finding in chimpanzee behavior evidence of ancient human bloodlust, writing, "Chimpanzee-like violence preceded and paved the way for human war, making modern humans the dazed survivors of a continuous 5-million-year habit of lethal aggression." Before the chimp came to be regarded as the best living model of ancestral human behavior, a much more distant relative, the savanna baboon, held that position. These ground-dwelling primates are adapted to the sort of ecological niche our ancestors likely occupied once they descended from the trees. The baboon model was abandoned when it became clear that they lack some fundamental human characteristics: cooperative hunting, tool use, organized warfare, and power struggles involving complex coalition building. Meanwhile, Jane Goodall and others were observing these qualities in chimpanzee behavior. Neuroscientist Robert Sapolsky, an expert on baboon behavior, notes that chimps are what baboons would love to be like if they had a shred of self-discipline. Perhaps it is not surprising, then, that so many scientists have assumed that chimpanzees are what humans would be like with just a bit less self-discipline. The importance of the chimpanzee in late 20th century models of human nature cannot be overstated. The maps we devise, or inherit from previous explorers, predetermine where we explore and what we'll find there. The cunning brutality displayed by chimpanzees, combined with the shameful cruelty that characterizes so much of human history, appears to confirm Hobbesian notions of human nature if left unrestrained by some greater force. Table 1. Social Organization Among Apes. Bonobo. Egalitarian and peaceful, bonobo communities are maintained primarily through social bonding between females, although females bond with males as well. Male status derives from the mother. Bonds between son and mother are lifelong. Multi-male, multi-female mating. Chimpanzee. The bonds between males are strongest and lead to constantly shifting male coalitions. Females move through overlapping ranges within territory patrolled by males, but don't form strong bonds with other females or any particular male. Multi-male, multi-female mating. Human. By far the most diverse social species among the primates, there is plentiful evidence of all types of socio-sexual bonding, cooperation, and competition among contemporary humans. Multi-male, multi-female mating. Unless you're sticking with the standard model, in which case humans are classified as monogamous or polygynous, depending on the source. Gorilla. Generally, a single dominant male, The so-called silverback occupies a range for his family unit composed of several females and young. Adolescent males are forced out of the group as they reach sexual maturity. Strongest social bonds are between the male and adult females. Polygynous mating. Orangutan. Orangutans are solitary and show little bonding of any kind. Male orangutans do not tolerate each other's presence. An adult male establishes a large territory where several females live. Each has her own range. Mating is dispersed, infrequent, and often violent. Gibbon. Gibbons establish nuclear family units. Each couple maintains a territory from which other pairs are excluded. Mating is monogamous. Doubting the chimpanzee model. There are, however, some serious problems with turning to chimpanzee behavior to understand prehistoric human societies. While chimps are extremely hierarchical, groups of human foragers are vehemently egalitarian. Meat sharing is precisely the occasion when chimp hierarchy is most evident, yet a successful hunt triggers the leveling mechanisms most important to human foraging societies. Most primatologists agree about the prominence of power consciousness in chimpanzees, but it may be premature to generalize from observations made at Gombe, given that observations made at different sites, Tai on the Ivory Coast of Western Africa, for example, suggest some wild chimps handle the sharing of meat in ways more reminiscent of human foragers. Primatologist Craig Stanford found that while the chimps at Gombe are utterly nepotistic and Machiavellian about meat distribution, the chimps at Tai share the meat among every individual in the hunting group, whether friend or foe, close relative or relative stranger. So, while data from the chimps studied by Goodall and others at Gombe appear to support the idea that a ruthless and calculating selfishness is typical of chimpanzee behavior, information from other study sites may contradict or undermine this finding. Given the difficulties inherent in observing chimpanzee behavior in the wild, we should be cautious about generalizing from the limited data we have available on free-ranging chimps. And given their indisputable intelligence and social nature, we should be equally suspicious of data collected from captive chimps, which would appear to be no more generalizable than human prisoner behavior would be to humans. There are also questions concerning how violent chimps are if left undisturbed in their natural habitat. As we discuss in Chapter 13, several factors could have profoundly altered the chimps' observed behavior. Cultural historian Morris Berman explains that if we change things such as food supplies, population densities, and the possibilities for spontaneous group formation and dissolution, all hell breaks loose, no less for apes than for humans. Even if we limit ourselves to the chimpanzee model, the dark self-assurance of modern-day neo-Hobbesian pessimists may be unfounded. Evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, for example, might be a bit less certain in his gloomy assessment of human nature. Be warned that if you wish, as I do, to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly towards a common good, you can expect little help from biological nature. Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. Maybe, but cooperation runs deep in our species too. Recent findings in comparative primate intelligence have led researchers Vanessa Woods and Brian Hare to wonder whether an impulse toward cooperation might actually be the key to our species-defining intelligence. They write, "Instead of getting a jump start with the most intelligent hominids surviving to produce the next generation, as is often suggested, it may have been the more social hominids, because they were better at solving problems together, who achieved a higher level of fitness and allowed selection to favor more sophisticated problem-solving over time. Humans got smart, they hypothesized, because our ancestors learned to cooperate. Innately selfish or not, the effects of food provisioning and habitat depletion on both wild chimpanzees and human foragers suggest that Dawkins and others who argue that humans are innately aggressive, selfish beasts should be careful about citing these chimp data in support of their case. human groups tend to respond to food surplus and storage with behavior like that observed in chimps. Heightened hierarchical social organization, intergroup violence, territorial perimeter defense, and Machiavellian alliances. In other words, humans, like chimps, tend to fight when there's something worth fighting over. But for most of prehistory, there was no food surplus to win or lose, and no home base to defend.
In search of primate continuity. Two elements women share with bonobos are that their ovulation is hidden from immediate detection, and that they have sex throughout their cycle. But here the similarities end. Where are our genital swellings? And where is the sex at the drop of a hat? Franz de Waal. Sex was an expression of friendship. In Africa, it was like holding hands. It was friendly and fun. There was no coercion. It was offered willingly. Paul Theroux.
Whatever one concludes about chimp violence and its relevance to human nature, our other closest primate cousin, the bonobo, offers a fascinating countermodel. Just as the chimpanzee seems to embody the Hobbesian vision of human origins, the bonobo reflects the Rousseauian view. Although best known today as the proponent of the noble sauvage, Rousseau's autobiography details a fascination with sexuality that suggests that he would have considered bonobos kindred souls had he known of them. De Waal sums up the difference between these two apes' behavior by saying that the chimpanzee resolves sexual issues with power, the bonobo resolves power issues with sex. Though bonobos surpass even chimps in the frequency of their sexual behavior, females of both species engage in multiple mating sessions in quick succession with different mates. Among chimpanzees, ovulating females mate on average from 6 to 8 times per day, and they are often eager to respond to the mating invitations of any and all males in the group. Describing the behavior of female chimps she monitored, primatologist Anne Pusey notes, "Each, after mating with her natal community, visited the other community while sexually receptive. They eagerly approached and mated with males from the new community." This extra-group sexual behavior is common among chimpanzees, suggesting that intergroup relations are not as violent as some claim. For example, a recent study of DNA samples taken from hair follicles collected from chimpanzee nests at the Taiyi study area in Ivory Coast showed that more than half the young, 7 of 13, had been fathered by males from outside the female's home group. Were these chimps living in a perpetual war zone, it's unlikely these females would have been free to slip away easily enough to account for over half their pregnancies. Ovulating female chimps, despite the heightened male monitoring predicted by the standard model, eluded their male protectors slash captors long enough to wander over to the other groups, mate with unfamiliar males, and then saunter back to their home group. This sort of behavior is unlikely in a state of perpetual high alert. Whatever the truth regarding relations between unprovisioned groups of chimpanzees in the wild, unconscious bias rings out in passages like this one. In war, as in romance, bonobos and chimpanzees appear to be strikingly different. When two bonobo communities meet at a range boundary at Wamba, not only is there no lethal aggression, as sometimes occurs in chimps, there may be socializing and even sex between females and the enemy community's males. Enemy? When two groups of intelligent primates get together to socialize and have sex with each other, who would think of these groups as enemies or such a meeting as war? Note the similar assumptions in this account. Chimpanzees give a special call that alerts others at a distance to the presence of food. As such, this is food sharing of sorts, but it need not be interpreted as charitable. A caller faced with more than enough food will lose nothing by sharing it and may benefit later when another chimpanzee reciprocates. Perhaps this seemingly cooperative behavior need not be interpreted as charitable, But what's the unspoken problem with such an interpretation? Why should we seek to explain away what looks like generosity among non-human primates or other animals in general? Is generosity a uniquely human quality? Passages like these make one wonder why, as Gould asked, scientists are loath to see primate continuity in our positive impulses, even as many clearly yearn to locate the roots of our aggression deep in primate past.
Just imagine that we had never heard of chimpanzees or baboons and had known bonobos first. We would, at present, most likely believe that early hominids lived in female-centered societies, in which sex served important social functions, and in which warfare was rare or absent. Franz de Waal.
Because they live only in a remote area of dense jungle, in a politically volatile country, Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire, bonobos were one of the last mammals to be studied in their natural habitat. Although their anatomical differences from common chimps were noted as long ago as 1929, until bonobos' radically different behavior became apparent, they were considered a subgroup of chimpanzee, often called pygmy chimps. For bonobos, female status is more important than male hierarchy, but even female rank is flexible and not binding. Bonobos have no formalized rituals of dominance and submission, like the status displays common to chimps, gorillas, and other primates. Although status is not completely absent, primatologist Takayoshi Kano, who has collected the most detailed information on bonobo behavior in the wild, prefers to use the term influential rather than high-ranking when describing female bonobos. He believes that females are respected out of affection rather than because of rank. Indeed, Franz de Waal wonders whether it's appropriate to discuss hierarchy at all among bonobos, noting, if there is a female rank order, it is largely based on seniority rather than physical intimidation. Older females are generally of higher status than younger ones. Those looking for evidence of matriarchy in human societies might ponder the fact that among bonobos, female dominance doesn't result in the sort of male submission one might expect if it were simply an inversion of the male power structures found among chimps and baboons. The female bonobos use their power differently than male primates. Despite their submissive social role, male bonobos appear to be much better off than male chimps or baboons. As we'll see in later discussions of female-dominated societies, human males also tend to fare pretty well when the women are in charge. While Sapolsky chose to study baboons because of the chronically high stress levels males suffer as a result of their unending struggles for power, de Waal notes that bonobos confront a different sort of existence, saying, "In view of their frequent sexual activity and low aggression, I find it hard to imagine that males of the species have a particularly stressful time." Crucially, humans and bonobos, but not chimps, appear to share a specific anatomical predilection for peaceful coexistence. Both species have what's called a repetitive microsatellite at gene AVPR1A, important to the release of oxytocin. Sometimes called nature's ecstasy, oxytocin is important in prosocial feelings like compassion, trust, generosity, love, and, yes, eroticism. As anthropologist and author Eric Michael Johnson explains, it is far more parsimonious that chimpanzees lost this repetitive microsatellite than for both humans and bonobos to independently develop the same mutation. But there is intense resistance to the notion that relatively low levels of stress and a surfeit of sexual freedom could have characterized the human past. Helen Fisher acknowledges these aspects of bonobo life as well as their many correlates in human behavior, and even makes a sly reference to Morgan's primal horde. These creatures travel in mixed groups of males, females, and young. Individuals come and go between groups, depending on the food supply, connecting a cohesive community of several dozen animals. Here is a primal horde. Sex is almost a daily pastime. Females copulate during most of their menstrual cycles, a pattern of coitus more similar to women's than any other creature's, bonobos engage in sex to ease tension, to stimulate sharing during meals, to reduce stress while traveling, and to reaffirm friendships during anxious reunions. Make love, not war, is clearly a bonobo scheme. Fisher then asks the obvious question, did our ancestors do the same? She seems to be preparing us for an affirmative answer by noting that bonobos display many of the sexual habits people exhibit on the streets, in the bars and restaurants, and behind apartment doors in New York, Paris, Moscow, and Hong Kong. Prior to coitus, she writes, bonobos often stare deeply into each other's eyes. And Fisher assures her readers that, like human beings, bonobos walk arm in arm, kiss each other's hands and feet, and embrace with long, deep, tongue-intruding French kisses. It seems that Fisher, who shares our doubts about other aspects of the standard narrative, is about to reconfigure her arguments concerning the advent of long-term pair bonding and other aspects of human prehistory to better reflect these behaviors shared by bonobos and humans. Given the prominent role of chimpanzee behavior in supporting the standard narrative, how can we not include the equally relevant bonobo data in our conjectures concerning human prehistory? Remember, we are genetically equidistant from chimps and bonobos. And, as Fisher notes, human sexual behavior has more in common with bonobos than with that of any other creature on Earth. But Fisher balks at acknowledging that the human sexual past could have been like the bonobo present, explaining her last-minute 180-degree turnaround by saying, bonobos have sex lives quite different from those of other apes. But this isn't true because humans, whose sexual behavior is so similar to that of bonobos, according to Fisher herself, are apes. She continues, bonobo heterosexual activities also occur throughout most of the menstrual cycle, and female bonobos resume sexual behavior within a year of parturition. Both these otherwise unique qualities of bonobo sexuality are shared by only one other primate species, Homo sapiens. But still, Fisher concludes, because pygmy chimps, bonobos, exhibit these extremes of primate sexuality, and because biochemical data suggest they emerged as recently as 2 million years ago, I do not feel they make a suitable model for life as it was among hominids 20 million years ago. This passage is bizarre on several levels. After writing at length about how strikingly similar bonobo sexual behavior is to that of human beings, Fisher executes a double backflip to conclude that they don't make a suitable model for our ancestors. To make matters even more confusing, she shifts the whole discussion to 20 million years ago as if she'd been talking about the last common ancestor of all apes, as opposed to that shared by chimps, bonobos, and humans, who diverged from a common ancestor only 5 million years ago. In fact, Fisher wasn't talking about such distant ancestors. The Anatomy of Love, the book from which we've been quoting, is a beautifully written popularization of her groundbreaking academic work on the evolution of serial pair bonding in humans, not all apes, within the past few million years. Furthermore, note how Fisher refers to the very qualities bonobos share with humans as extremes of primate sexuality. Further hints of neo-Victorianism appear in Fisher's description of the transition our ancestors made from the treetops to life on land. Perhaps our primitive female ancestors living in the trees pursued sex with a variety of males to keep friends. Then, when our forebears were driven onto the grasslands of Africa some 4 million years ago, and pair bonding evolved to raise the young, females turned from open promiscuity to clandestine copulations, reaping the benefits of resources and better or more varied genes as well. Fisher assumes the advent of pair bonding 4 million years ago, despite the absence of any supporting evidence. Continuing this circular reasoning, she writes, because bonobos appear to be the smartest of the apes, because they have many physical traits quite similar to people's, and because these chimps copulate with flair and frequency, some anthropologists conjecture that bonobos are much like the African hominoid prototype, our last common tree-dwelling ancestor. Maybe pygmy chimps are living relics of our past, but they certainly manifest some fundamental differences in their sexual behavior. For one thing, bonobos do not form long-term pair bonds the way humans do. Nor do they raise their young as husband and wife. Males do care for infant siblings, but monogamy is no life for them. Promiscuity is their fare. Here we have crystalline expression of the Flintstonizing that can distort the thinking of even the most informed theorists on the origins of human sexual behavior. We are confident Dr. Fisher will find that what she calls fundamental differences in sexual behavior are not differences at all when she looks at the full breadth of information we cover in following chapters. We'll show that husband-wife marriage and sexual monogamy are far from universal human behaviors, as she and others have argued. Simply because bonobos raise doubts about the naturalness of human long-term pair bonding, Fisher and most other authorities conclude that they cannot serve as models for human evolution. They begin by assuming that long-term sexual monogamy forms the nucleus of the one and only natural, eternal human family structure, and reasons backwards from there. Yucatan be damned.
I sometimes try to imagine what would have happened if we'd known the bonobo first, and chimpanzee only later, or not at all. The discussion about human evolution might not revolve as much around violence, warfare, and male dominance, but rather around sexuality, empathy, caring, and cooperation. What a different intellectual landscape we would occupy. Franz de Waal, Our Inner Ape.
The weakness of the killer ape theory of human origins becomes clear in light of what's now known about bonobo behavior. Still, de Waal makes a good case that even without the data that became available in the 1970s, the many flaws in the chimp-fortified Hobbesian view eventually would have emerged. He calls attention to the fact that the theory confuses predation with aggression, assumes that tools originated as weapons, and depicts women as passive objects of male competition. He calls for a new scenario that acknowledges and explains the virtual absence of organized warfare among today's human foragers, their egalitarian tendencies, and generosity with information and resources across groups. By projecting recent post-agricultural preoccupations with female fidelity into their vision of prehistory, many theorists have Flintstonized their way right into a cul-de-sac. Modern man's seemingly instinctive impulse to control women's sexuality is not an intrinsic feature of human nature. It is a response to specific historical socioeconomic conditions, conditions very different from those in which our species evolved. This is key to understanding sexuality in the modern world. De Waal is correct that this hierarchical, aggressive, and territorial behavior is of recent origin for our species. It is, as we'll see, an adaptation to the social world that arose with agriculture. From our perspective on the far bank, Helen Fisher, Franz de Waal, and a few others seem to have ventured out onto the bridge that crosses over the rushing stream of unfounded assumptions about human sexuality, but they dare not cross it. Their positions seem to us to be compromises that strain against the most parsimonious interpretation of data they know as well as anyone. Confronted with the unignorable fact that human beings sure don't act like a monogamous species, they make excuses for our aberrant, yet perplexingly consistent, behavior. Fisher explains the phenomenon of worldwide marital breakdown by arguing that the pair bond evolved to last only until the infant grows to a child who can keep up with the foraging band without fatherly assistance. For his part, de Waal still argues that the nuclear family is intrinsically human, and the pair bond is the key to the incredible level of cooperation that marks our species. But he then suggestively concludes that our success as a species is intimately tied to the abandonment of the bonobo lifestyle and to a tighter control over sexual expressions. Abandonment? Since it's impossible to abandon what one never had, DeWall would presumably agree that hominid sexuality was, at some point, profoundly similar to that of the relaxed, promiscuous bonobo, although he never says so explicitly. Nor has he ventured to say when or why our ancestors abandoned that way of being. Table 2. Comparison of bonobo, chimp, and human sociosexual behavior and infant development. Human and bonobo females copulate throughout menstrual cycle, as well as during lactation and pregnancy. Female chimps are sexually active only 25% to 40% of their cycle. Human and bonobo infants develop much more slowly than chimpanzees, beginning to play with others at about 1.5 years, much later than chimps. Like humans, female bonobos return to the group immediately after giving birth and copulate within months. They exhibit little fear of infanticide, which has never been observed in bonobos, captive or free living. Bonobos and humans enjoy many different copulatory positions, with ventral-ventral missionary position appearing to be preferred by bonobo females and rear entry by males, while chimps prefer rear entry almost exclusively. Bonobos and humans often gaze into each other's eyes when copulating and kiss each other deeply. Chimps do neither. The vulva is located between the legs and oriented toward the front of the body in humans and bonobos, rather than oriented toward the rear as in chimps and other primates. Food sharing is highly associated with sexual activity in humans and bonobos, only moderately so in chimps. There is a high degree of variability in potential sexual combinations in humans and bonobos. Homosexual activity is common in both, but rare in chimps. Genital-genital GG rubbing between female bonobos appears to affirm female bonding, is present in all bonobo populations studied, wild and captive, and is completely absent in chimpanzees. Human data on GG rubbing are presently unavailable. Attention, ambitious graduate students. While sexual activity in chimps and other primates appears to be primarily reproductive, bonobos and humans utilize sexuality for social purposes, tension reduction, bonding, conflict resolution, entertainment, etc. Part 2. Lust in Paradise, Solitary. Chapter 5. Who lost what in paradise?
Man has imagined a heaven, and has left entirely out of it the supremest of all his delights, the one ecstasy that stands first and foremost in the heart of every individual of his race. Sexual intercourse. It is as if a lost and perishing person in a roasting desert should be told by a rescuer he might choose and have all longed-for things but one. And he should elect to leave out water. Mark Twain, Letters from the Earth.
Turns out the Garden of Eden wasn't really a garden at all. It was anything but a garden. Jungle, forest, wild seashore, open savanna, wind-blown tundra. Adam and Eve weren't kicked out of a garden, they were kicked into one. Think about it. What's a garden? Land under cultivation, tended, arranged, organized, intentional. Weeds are pulled or poisoned without mercy, seeds are selected and sown. There's nothing free or spontaneous about such a place, accidents are unwelcome. But the story says that before their fall from grace, Adam and Eve lived carefree, naked, and innocent, lacking nothing. Their world provided what they needed, food, shelter, and companionship. But after the fall, the good times were over. Food, previously the gift of a generous world, now had to be earned through hard work. Women suffered in giving birth. And sexual pleasure, formerly guilt-free, became a source of humiliation and shame. Although the biblical story has it that the first humans were expelled from the garden, the narrative clearly got reversed somewhere along the line. The curse suffered by Adam and Eve centers around the exchange of the arguably low-stress, high-pleasure life of foragers, or bonobos, for the dawn-to-dusk toil of a farmer in his garden. Original sin represents the attempt to explain why on earth our ancestors ever accepted such a raw deal. The story of the fall gives narrative structure to the traumatic transition from the take-it-where-you-find-it hunter-gatherer existence to the arduous struggle of agriculturalists. Contending with insects, rodents, weather, and the reluctant earth itself, farmers were forced to earn their bread by the sweat of their brow, rather than just finding the now-forbidden fruit and eating it hand-to-mouth as their ancestors had done forever. No wonder foragers have almost never shown any interest in learning farming techniques from Europeans. As one forager put it, "Why should we plant when there are so many Mongongo nuts in the world?" Books like this one concerning human nature are beacons for trouble. On one hand, everybody's an expert. Being human, we all have opinions about human nature. Such an understanding seems to require little more than a modicum of common sense and some attention to our own incessant cravings and aversions. Simple enough. But making sense of human nature is anything but simple. Human nature has been landscaped, replanted, weeded, fertilized, fenced off, seeded, and irrigated as intensely as any garden or seaside golf course. Human beings have been under cultivation longer than we've been cultivating anything else. Our cultures domesticate us for obscure purposes, nurturing and encouraging certain aspects of our behavior and tendencies, while seeking to eliminate those that might be disruptive. Agriculture, one might say, has involved the domestication of the human being as much as of any plant or other animal. Our sense of the full range of human nature, like our diet, has been steadily reduced. No matter how nourishing it might be, anything wild gets pulled. Though, as we'll see, some of the weeds growing in us have roots reaching deep into our shared past. Pull them if you want, but they'll just keep coming back again and again. What gets cultivated in soil and mines is not necessarily beneficial to the individuals in a given society. Something may benefit a culture overall, while being disastrous to the majority of the individual members of that society. Individuals suffer and die in wars from which a society may benefit greatly. Industrial poisons in the air and water, globalized trade accords, genetically modified crops, all are accepted by individuals likely to end up losing in the deal. This disconnect between individual and group interests helps explain why the shift to agriculture is normally spun as a great leap forward, despite the fact that it was actually a disaster for most of the individuals who endured it. Skeletal remains taken from various regions of the world, dating to the transition from foraging to farming, all tell the same story. Increased famine, vitamin deficiency, stunted growth, radical reduction in lifespan, increased violence, little cause for celebration. For most people, we'll see that the shift from foraging to farming was less a giant leap forward than a dizzying fall from grace. On getting funky and rocking round the clock. If you ever doubt that human beings are, beyond everything, social animals, consider that short of outright execution or physical torture, the worst punishment in any society's arsenal has always been exile. Having run short of empty places to exile our worst prisoners, we've turned to internal exile as our harshest punishment, solitary confinement. Sartre got it backwards when he proclaimed, "L'enfer, c'est les autres." Hell is other people. It's the absence of other people that is hellish for our species. Human beings are so desperate for social contact that prisoners almost universally choose the company of murderous lunatics over extended isolation. "I would rather have had the worst companion than no companion at all," said journalist Terry Anderson, recalling his 7-year ordeal as a hostage in Lebanon. Evolutionary theorists love to seek explanations for species' most outstanding features. The elk's antlers, the giraffe's neck, the cheetah's breakaway speed. These features reflect the environment in which the species evolved and the particular niche it occupies in this environment. What's our species' outstanding feature? Other than our supersized male genitalia, we're not very impressive from a physical perspective. With less than half our body weight, the average chimp has the strength of any 4 or 5 mustachioed firefighters. Plenty of animals can run faster, dive deeper, fight better, see farther, detect fainter smells, and hear tonal subtleties in what sounds like silence to us. So what do we